Hey guys, welcome back again to Hear Our Voices. It's your host, K-Did. Thank you for coming back to hear the rest of Cynthia's story. And I'm just so happy that she became the woman that she is today. She has lived a long life thus far, and I hope she continues to live. And she's been through so many trials and tribulations. But as you can see and hear, depending on what kind of platform you're listening to this on right now, that she has made it. She has really made it past a lot of the trials. And obviously, until you croak off, you're going to go through problems at all times. But she's showing you that you can persevere no matter if you're going through DV, if you're going through homelessness, if you're going through a mental health crisis. It doesn't matter what part you have in your life or what life throws at you. You can make it. You can succeed. So I hope you're getting that from her story and what she's telling you insight in. She had love. She had life. And you know from the beginning, she also had death in her family. So thank you for listening. Thank you for being a person who's just sharing our content out to other people. So I want to also say, can you find us on social media? The link will be down in the bio. We also have a resource packet. Anybody who needs help in New York City, because that's the one resource packet we have at this moment. Anybody in New York City who wants to get help and resources, and it could be illegal, it could be for DV, it could be for clothes, food, shelter, mostly just clothes, food, furniture, things like that. We are giving you this resource packet to be able to help you and your family, whether you're in shelter or you're not in out shelter. It's all about getting the things that you need to survive in this world. So hopefully that can be helpful to you and your family. And thank you for listening. And let's listen on to our story.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about supportive housing before we end the podcast?
Oh yeah, that's what, thank you. That was the thought that I lost. Okay, yes. I am a huge proponent of supportive housing. And I will tell anyone who is in the shelter system or drop-in center or wherever they are, if they get a supportive housing application, fill it out and hope they qualify. Number one, it is the fastest growing set of units because
that's what it seems like. Yeah.
Yeah. The state promised us several years ago, 15,000 new units by such and such date. They have only fulfilled it by half, but they're putting up more supportive housing because they're realizing that the level of mental illness in this city is much higher than they thought.
Especially they're sending that from Corona, though. Let's be honest. Corona yes. was already messed up from before, but people are messed up stuck in their house with their abuser even more.
Yes.
So
yes.
They should have known, to be honest.
Yes, exactly. So it's escalated. So yes, I say the type of supportive housing that I was in is a scattered site, non-HASA scattered site. Okay. Mm-hmm. What that means is it was a regular one-bedroom apartment in a regular old apartment building, but under that 80-20 rule that I spoke about earlier, where landlords who own more than 100 units have to provide 20% to supportive or low-income housing. Right. So there were like, I don't know, 4 or 5 apartments in my building that were set aside for supportive housing. Because of my mobility issues, mine was a ground floor, one-bedroom apartment. Right. Okay? What happened was I went to see them in the office once a month. They came and visited the apartment once a month, not to spy on me, but to make sure that I had everything that I needed and that the apartment was in good repair, because obviously with supportive housing, it's a sublease.
Right.
Okay. You're leasing it from the provider, Volunteers of America, Acacia, whoever the provider may be.
Right.
Okay. You're leasing the apartment from them. So they come and they make sure that you have everything that you need, that your fire extinguisher is full, that you're not, you know, living under squalid conditions. And then you go to their office once a month. I used to pick rent day. So every day I would go pay my little, because I was on Social Security disability. So with supportive housing, you understand it's 30% of your income.
Like NYCHA. Yes.
Yeah. It's 30% of your income. So I was getting $1,500 a month, I think, from Social Security disability. and my rent never went over $300. And I lived there for 7 years. And that was utilities included. All I had to pay was cable and rent. Okay. But they make sure that you have everything that you need in these programs. They make sure that the apartment is safe and secure. There are some rules, like nobody's supposed to live with you. You know, if you can have company, but, you know, they have to leave within a certain number of days. I think it's 3 days or whatever. But I, in fact, my youngest daughter came to live with me in that apartment. And the program that I was with that supplied my supportive housing was Volunteers of America. And the caseworker that I had, shout out to you, Miss Anthony.
She was make a little very, job now.
No. She doesn't work for them anymore.
Okay, so Miss Anthony's all right. Yeah. Thank you, Miss Anthony.
Yeah. But she knew my... I was honest with her. I said, look, I just got custody of my daughter back after fighting for all these years. And yeah, my daughter is not sleeping here on the weekends. She's here every day and she goes to school over there. And she said, okay, look, make sure that I come when she's in school, you know, because you're allowed to have visitors on the weekend, right? So... according to the agency, my daughter was visiting me on weekends, but my daughter was actually living with me. But I say that to say, not to encourage breaking the rules.
Right.
But I say that to show how much freedom one can have in supportive housing.
Right.
People who are in the shelter system, they have this idea that supportive housing is only the on-site care kind of thing where you have to still sign in and out. And, you know, they monitor your medication and all these other things. That's for a different level of person who needs care.
Right.
I'm independent and I'm capable of independence. So they provided the supportive housing that was at my level. So do not be afraid of supportive housing. Do not be afraid to admit that you have a diagnosis, because it can be your saving grace. The hardest people to get apartments for in this system are general population people.
It's true.
Yes.
It's true.
People with no diagnoses, no histories of any this or that, who just lost their apartment because they lost their job, because they got a divorce or whatever. Those are the hardest people to get an apartment for in this system. Yeah. So don't be afraid to admit that you have mental health needs. And don't be afraid, you should apply for supportive housing, because that 2010E that I got approved for, if I ever become homeless again, they have to put me in back in another supportive housing unit, even though I signed myself out of supportive housing.
Oh, wow. You did.
I did. When I was in the hospital and my mother was having, she lives in a duplex that my grandmother left her. And she was having trouble paying her mortgage because the tenant that she had upstairs wasn't paying the rent. So, and she was in the process of eviction. So I, being the fool that I am, and I only say that because my mother and I have never had a good relationship, but I've been chasing it all my life.
Right.
So when she said she needed help, I pulled up stakes, signed out of my apartment, dragged my poor daughter with me, and we went to go live with my mother, and I paid her bills for, I don't know, 6 months or so till I wasn't welcome anymore. But then Cousin Sharon died, and my daughter,
my cousin Sharon.
Yeah, Cousin Sharon passed away, but she left my daughter
this place.
The place to my daughter.
Shout out to Cousin Sharon. She was doing
I'm telling you, man. If it wasn't for Cousin Sharon, boy, a whole lot of things wouldn't be the way they are. I'm telling you.
The Cousin Sharon. For real.
That was the angel. That was the angel. She was not only was she a licensed social worker, but you know, she was just an angel to everybody in her life. And you know, she unfortunately died of a heart attack in this very apartment. With my daughter and my grandson here. You know, having to deal with that situation. But what happened was, when this happened, I knew my daughter needed me more than my mother did. My mother didn't appreciate my presence anyway.
Right.
So my daughter needed me, my grandson needed me. So I packed up my stuff.
As you did.
moved in, came to take care of my babies.
My cousin Sharon and babies. Mm-hmm.
That's right. Right. As you That's should. Right.
Cousin Sharon was doing everything. He's like, everything. Let me tell you something. Cousin Sharon got your kids holding that. Yeah, cousin Sharon.
So I come to do Aunt Sharon proud, you know. But yeah, that's supportive housing is a good thing. Now, like anything, like any apartment building or complex or whatever, it's only as good as the people that run it and the people that live in it. So every program is different. Right. But based on my personal lived experience, as well as my experience dealing with the homeless population, supportive housing is nowhere near a bad thing.
Okay.
Not a bad thing at all. And if it's offered to you and it's enough space for you and your family, take it. Because the supportive services that you will get will make a difference. I used to get a gift card from the agency every year, go like down to the pantry once a month and get a turkey, get some chicken wings, get, you know, some veggies and stuff. Come, they would always tell you, we got pantry, bring your shopping cart. Okay? Sounds then, yes, then when I was having problems with mental health providers, who was it that found me the new provider? My caseworker at my supportive housing agency. Okay. So supportive housing in my book is a good thing. And the 7 years that I was there really helped me get grounded in living again.
That's good.
Okay, because that was the apartment that I learned to sleep all night in the bed again. Because when I was in shelter, the last shelter I was in, it was a mental health shelter, and they understood my trauma. So when I needed to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning because I'm having a panic attack because the walls are closing in on me and I needed to get, so shout out to CUCS too, because they saved my life. They would let me get out of bed and go stand in front of the building, smoke a cigarette, shake it off. Just as long as I stayed in view of the camera, you know, they would let me do what I needed to do and then go back in the building and go to bed. And they made sure that I took my medication every day. They made sure that there was a therapist for me to talk to. There was a psychiatrist for me to see. There was the proper case manager for me to build a rapport with and let into my life. And that's another thing. Last thing I'm going to say, you got to let people into your life. I know you've been traumatized. I know you've been hurt. I know people have kicked you off their couch, you know, and out of their kitchen and made you feel real bad about yourself. But you gotta let people in because there are good people out there that will help you, will help your kids, not only help you survive, but teach you how to thrive.
That's good.
So that's my word to everybody.
I wanna also say that they just need to have more, I feel like I always hear about supportive housing for like single people usually and not for families as much. I could be totally wrong. But I feel like they have more services for families. Because I feel like people don't think about moms and dads needing we need supportive stuff too. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
It could be a lot. Especially I feel like probably honestly, all people who leave the shelter probably need the supportive housing for a little bit, like that kind of service for a little bit. Because as you know, it's traumatizing. So people might think they're okay, cool and great until 6 months down the line, depression is kicking your butt.
because you didn't think about it, you know? You're sitting around your new place one day. With your little, you know, you got your furniture money and this and that, and you're sitting around and you're able to go to the stove and cook your own food and this and that, and you don't understand why you're falling apart.
Right.
It's because people, a lot of us are, I'm one of those people. I'm really, really good during a crisis. You wouldn't think I had a nerve in me.
Right.
But when the crisis is over and everything's done, I go sit in the corner and fall apart.
Yeah.
Okay, so same thing with getting your housing. You've pushed and pushed and fought and fought and fought. Now the fight is over in a certain sense. But you've been traumatized by the experience.
Been drained. Yeah.
Drained, yes. And the constant filling out of applications and thinking, oh God, please let this be the one. And then it's never the one.
Right.
Until it finally is the one. But that roller coaster of emotions that we're on that have gone unchecked because we're not getting mental health care because we don't realize that now we have a bigger problem than we had when we started because of all of the circumstances. Losing your housing under any circumstance is terribly traumatic, and it's not a one-day event. It's a series of events that lead to that ultimate event of homelessness.
Yes.
And all of those events leading up to that climax are traumatic. And then you're re-traumatized or continually traumatized in the shelter system.
Right.
Okay. They don't mean to traumatize, but they don't really know what they're doing. Because if they knew what they were doing, they would have adequate staffing. They would have the stock of apartments available so that nobody had to stay in the system for 1 to 3 years.
Exactly.
Average. Some 6 years or more.
Right.
Okay. And then the recidivism would not occur the way that it does. I don't know the numbers on the recidivism rate, but I know that it's because they deliberately don't track what happens to people when they get out of the system.
That's the thing, they need to.
They don't do it. So they may know, and you know, when you've been out of the system for more than a year, everything shuts down and now you have to start all over again if you come back in the system. So if you've been out of the system for 5 years or 10 years, you come back, you're starting all over again. Nobody has been tracking you from the day you got into the system to today to make sure you stay safe. What about preventative care?
Right. That's what about education,
aftercare? You and I as lay people say, well, that's obvious to me.
Right.
But these experts with all of these degrees and all of this vetting that they do to get into DHS, you know how many months of vetting prospective employees have to go through?
Yeah, they really
do. It's a lot. And so because of that extended vetting process, which on one hand you would think would be a good thing, right? Because they're scrutinizing to get the right kind of people, right?
Right.
Which they most often do not, and we know that.
Exactly.
But all that time that they're using to onboard new people, the people that are already in the system are suffering because they're not getting adequate care.
Right.
Because instead of having only 25 cases, a case manager has 50 cases.
Right.
There's no DSS. There's no housing specialist.
Yes, that's so true.
Right? How are people supposed to get through the system when the basic resources of personnel are not even there?
That's true.
So the people that are there they don't know how to teach anything. They don't have time to teach anything. And because you're not getting a good response from the staff, then you cease to care.
Mm-hmm.
Or you get angry and start acting out. And then you end up getting transferred from shelter to shelter to shelter to shelter as punishment.
Right.
And each shelter, you're getting uglier and uglier and uglier because you're more and more and more traumatized. So there's a lot of things wrong with the system. A lot of things could be improved, but yet and still, based on what we know, it's the best system in this country. And I say that with a really huge block of salt because it is such a flawed system.
It definitely is.
Other countries, we already know, you know, this United States has such a false sense of pride because
they do.
Other countries have had the same problems. They've had the gun issue, which we refuse to take care of.
Right.
They've had housing issues, homelessness, etc. You go to countries like Finland, Denmark, other places in the UK. You'll see a few homeless people.
Right. But it's not like America. It's not.
No. And if you have no income in Great Britain, they have a thing called a council house, which is an apartment, which I believe is free or income-based. So if you're in a position where you have no income other than, you know, what they're giving you to help you get along, you still got a roof over your head and your children's head. We call it the projects here. They call it council houses, estates, you know.
Because they got the fancy, the queen.
Exactly. But there are other things in other systems that have worked very well. You know that Denmark, I think it was Denmark, got a handle on their drug problem by being open about the drug problem and providing places for people to go and safely do their drugs, buy their drugs, etc. So they're not buying a bunch of fentanyl-based things and dirty needles and all of that. You know what I'm saying? So we need to stop having these blinders on and thinking that we know it all in this country.
It's not blinders, though. It's more of a cover-up. Because we see the problem. We're covering up the problem with the Band-Aid was honestly leaking through at this point. To give you visual. That's what's happening.
We're hemorrhaging. We've been telling the Coalition and the Legal Aid, Coalition for the Homeless, Legal Aid Society has been telling DHS and HRA that they are not prepared for a homelessness disaster. We didn't know what the disaster was going to be.
We've been having disasters, but
we knew there was not enough capacity, right?
Right.
It could have been a nuclear war. Right. It could have been a, you know, like how San Francisco went on fire and, you know, two-thirds of the city was burned down or whatever. It could have been anything like that. Tell y'all do not have enough capacity for a true emergency.
We don't.
And now look what's happened. The emergency happens to come in immigrants, in the form of immigrants, but it's an emergency still that you were not prepared for and should have been. Because we've been telling you for 40 years.
Huh? They're never prepared. They always, they're like, they, you tell them to do it in advance, they always like caught off guard, like, oh my God, it's happening. No, for example, coronavirus shouldn't have been a big shock. Why? Because we had the Spanish flu. We had the Black Death.
We've had other pandemics. We've had AIDS pandemic in my lifetime. Come on, nothing new.
Exactly.
Do you notice here in New York that it snows every winter, but every winter they act like it's the first time they've seen snow?
Oh, my God. But have you noticed that? Been snowing. It's been lacking, honestly. Since I was like, but I understand what you mean. Like, I think, I don't know. The snow hasn't been snowing like it used to be. But
it
actually is a new phenomenon.
Like it did when I was a kid.
They make it seem like we have, in the 90s, we had snow. And we still had to go to school. Y'all kids nowadays don't got to go nowhere.
Well, imagine, I was here in the 60s, honey. Mm. And my daddy, I'm 5'11". I was 4'11" by the time I was, I don't know, 6 or 7. Mm. My daddy used to have to, and my daddy was 6'5". My daddy used to have to pick me up and put me on his shoulders to walk me through the snow in New York.
Wow.
When I was a little girl, okay? Now, I can't even get together a snowball to hit my grandson.
Right. Just have a little fun. Just a little fun.
You know? But the point is that it happens every year. And if it didn't happen this year, it may happen next year.
Right.
But every year, y'all act like you ain't never seen a snowflake before.
Oh, my God. It snowed. Like, we live in, like, they're going to see, like, we live in Jamaica, and all of a sudden, there's snow in Jamaica.
Right. Then I'd be shocked.
Don't be shocked.
When I lived in LA, we didn't even get freaked out like that when it snowed there once or twice.
Oh my God. It was hilarious.
In the 70s, you know? But, you know, we have to keep shining a light on these things because, you know, the average person who doesn't have, and I don't know who's left now, who doesn't have any experience with either substance abuse disorder, mental health dysfunction, domestic violence, homelessness, all of these things. And anyone who's out there listening and has not had these experiences, this is why a podcast like yours is so important, Khadijah, because though the audience may be small right now, it is going to grow. Right. And one thing that I truly believe whenever I'm giving talks, doing podcasts or live speaking or whatever it is that if you touch one person in the crowd, if one person in the crowd leaves you better informed than they were when they walked in, then you've done your job.
Right.
And that one person needs to tell another person and so on and so on and so on. We all have an obligation, especially those of us with lived experience who are able to advocate for themselves and others, we have an absolute obligation to pay this forward because we did have the privilege of surviving. I cannot tell you how many of those good souls who kept me alive as a woman in the streets, I cannot tell you how many of them are no longer with us.
Right.
Okay. They didn't make it out, but I did. Or I made it in, let's say. I made it indoors, right?
Right.
I owe them and all of the people who let me wash their car in summertime or do their laundry or go get their coffee in the wintertime or dig their cars out of the snow or whatever it is that they did to help me, I owe it to them as well. Because they saw something in me as a human being that made them choose me as the person they wanted to assist. Mm-hmm. And they didn't have to do that. So I owe it to all of those people to push forward and pay it forward. And so even though I've left my job at the Coalition, I'm still doing as much as I can with the Speakers Bureau, the HUD project that I'm doing that also has to do with seniors. This podcast, I'm doing a symposium in upstate New York in April regarding homelessness and the criminal justice system and the effect that the intermingling of these things, you know, things like how people are now mandated to shelter because the prisons are too lazy or too inept to do a proper discharge plan and make sure that a person has a proper place to live before they, especially if they've done a long time. Right. They've been in for a long time and you spit them out into the shelter system.
That's going to be no good.
It's not good. And it causes people to reoffend. Right. I've known people who have told me in my face, Cynthia, I did 30 years and I've been out for a year in this friggin' shelter system and I'm getting ready to commit a small crime, violate my parole and go back because it was easier living in jail than it is here.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Nothing sadder than that. A person whose whole life has been eaten up by a mistake that they made in their youth and now they come out. There was one young man I met who, I don't know, he did 5 or 10 years or whatever it was. And his family was more than willing to have him come home. It was a particular sister, aunt, or somebody like that. Do you know that the probation department denied or the parole department denied his residency there because the woman had a pit bull?
What? What a dog gotta do if somebody stays?
Okay.
I don't understand.
The woman had a pit bull. Had nothing to do with the man's criminal life. I think he had been in a gang when he was young or something like that.
What the hell is a pit bull? Because
pit bulls are associated in some people's minds with gang members. So
a breed of a dog?
They arbitrarily decided to mandate him to the shelter system because his relative had a dog.
I understand that they said, oh, he kills birds and maybe he'll kill the dog. I think I'll take the... But because of a pip?
Yes. I've got 1,000 anecdotes from over the years of things that will just make you, it just make you wonder how the world even functions because of the arbitrary stupidity and callousness of human beings in charge, you know? And in fact, I've known a lot of people in the shelter system who reoffended either because the system was taking too long to get them a place to live. They were tired of having their freedom restricted in the way that shelter does. You know, at least when you're in prison, and this is sad to say, at least when you're in prison, you have your own cell, your own toilet. You go to commissary. When your family sends you money, you get a job if you're able to in jail, so you make your own money, and the food is better.
Wow.
Really? So it a lot has got to be fixed. We've got to keep working on it, you know, and once we get through this period, and hopefully, you know, the federal government will step in and give us some relief for the immigrants, give the state or these states that are helping the immigrants, give us more assistance so that we can do a proper job.
Right.
Because those people are, if you think we're traumatized, imagine, you know, fighting from the jungles of Ecuador to get to the United States.
Right.
And this is what you're faced with.
Right.
You know? Once we get over this hump, hopefully it will open people's eyes to what is really going on in the system. Okay. Right. The fact that the right to shelter is being challenged could be a good thing if it doesn't get overturned, because it would give us, we advocates, an opportunity to fight for other things within the right to shelter, like having families fully vested in the right to shelter so that they have all of the same rights as single adults. Single adults, because it's adult families and families with children that are not fully vested in the right to shelter, and they need that protection. Hopefully, if it does start to get scrutinized on our side, there are things that need to be added in, things that were not known when right to shelter was first established, like the fact that a congregate situation can be very dangerous for some people's mental health.
It sure can.
Everybody's not built to live like that, you know? The fact that the long stays in the shelter system are not good for people's mental and physical health, or for children's mental and physical health. I did an inspection at a family shelter a couple of summers ago. It was pre-pandemic. And the children were American citizens, but the mother was undocumented.
Right.
The oldest daughter pulled me to the side, and she said, "I'm getting ready to graduate middle school and go into high school, and I've been in this shelter since I was in fourth grade. Help us get out?" And the reason that they can't get out
is the mom. Because
the mother is undocumented. So until one of them turns 18 and can be head of household, they're stuck.
Dang.
They're stuck. And so we're not only talking about the new immigrants, we're talking about people whose parents brought them here 50 years ago, but they just never, for whatever reason, they never got their documents. It never seemed to be a thing, because you see, when I was a kid, it wasn't a big deal if you didn't have your documents.
Right.
Because a lot of people were getting paid under the table, and it wasn't a big deal.
Right.
Right? We had our documents, and we got paid under the table. Because it was just, you know, you did a little job, and you got your money. And
a little something, something. Right.
Yeah. You know, and they didn't have to pay no taxes, and everybody
Was happy. Hopefully, right. Uncle Sam don't listen to this, but you know.
Yeah, but we can't do it like that no more. It's dangerous. Right. You know? People go to jail now for that.
Right.
We've got to figure out a way to provide housing for the undocumented. I call them Americans because they've been in this country. That some of them, you know, some kids were born here or brought here. What do they call them? The dreamers, right?
Yes.
They've been here since they were 2 or 3 years old.
Yeah.
You know, and now there's no recourse for them.
Right.
When they've spent their whole lives here, but for a piece of paperwork.
Right. It's crazy. It's really crazy.
And it's wrong. And it's wrong. Because they contribute, like I said, homeless people pay taxes every day.
Mm-hmm.
Every time they buy a cup of coffee for a dollar, they pay taxes, or a bag of chips or toilet paper. They pay
taxes. We don't need toilet paper. We saw what happened in the pandemic.
Okay, and listen, and in the shelter system, you'd be surprised about the toilet paper shortage. They blame it on the clients.
Nah. They don't try to get. They don't try to give you toilet paper like that in the shelter. When I
they don't want to give it to you. No, and their excuse is because clients clog the toilet. But I'm not clogging no toilet.
Right.
Why I get three sheets of toilet paper, right, or I have to go buy my own?
I had to buy my own. I was tight, but you know, yeah. I lived through
but
it.
Listen, but listen, when I was in shelter, toilet paper only cost like 35 cents a roll.
Right.
So I could pick pennies up off the street, you know, and get 35 cents, you know. But the basic needs not being met make you feel debased, makes you feel less than human, you know. And they really, a proper shelter should be a training ground.
Right.
It should be, because I call homelessness the great equalizer, because it doesn't matter where you come from. When you end up homeless, everything that's meant for me is meant for you too.
Right.
No matter where you came from, how you got there. Right. In my last experience in the shelter system, I got insight into myself. I got education about my disease. I got training on how to maintain my mental health. I got coaching from competent therapists who gave me the emotional life skills training that I did not have before. They started me on that track to really being well. And that's, in my experience, in my opinion, that's what shelters should do.
Right.
They should address. I don't know if you remember back in the day, if you got on public assistance, you had to go for education or training in order to receive that public assistance, right? Mm-hmm. So everybody was getting skills, right? Well, when you come out of 3 years out of the shelter system, unless you've had someone to guide you, you're no better off than when you went in. The only thing is now you've got an apartment for a couple of years.
It's true.
And they need to fix that. They really need to fix that, especially for families with children. It should be across the board for everyone.
Right.
But especially families with children, there should be additional resources provided to the families. Okay? Because like I told you, my son is almost 40 years old, and he's still wounded from his shelter experience when he was 12. So I hope we get it together. We got a new year. It's a new year. Yes, let's do great things.
Right. I want to say, guys, as we come to the end of the podcast, that thank you again, Cynthia, for coming on and being our guest for today. We have a lot of insight. Absolutely. This is probably going to be a 4 or 5 part. You know how I do it. Cut it up when it's long.
Listen.
So I hope you enjoy. I hope you have your popcorn. I hope you got little chips on the side. Or if you're going to exercise and listen,
that's
I hope
you enjoy this podcast.
Yes. Guys, also,
I enjoyed it.
As you can see from the podcast, the system is broken. When I say we have a perfect system here, but we can do, if anybody who listens to this podcast, as she said, can take a part of it and then tell somebody else, we all can get on the same page to make the world better. We're not going to solve all problems, but we can solve this particular problem. Take care of your family, your loved ones, everything we talked about, any resources in this podcast, you will definitely see down below. And just kiss your loved ones, love your loved ones. Call that friend who you haven't heard in a while, because they probably are going down bad. It takes time to get to the downfall. Don't make them get to the point where there's hardly no return. So please check on your friends. Also, guys, check us out, share us, follow us on social media. Everything will be down below. And I love you guys. Thank you for listening.
Khadija, I want you to put my email in the thing, okay? In case anybody wants any one-on-one conversation.
All right, guys. Okay. Thank you.
That's my next thing. I'm going into peer support.
Ooh.
Yeah.
We'll be having a topic about that probably in the next future, too. So talk to you guys.
Okay, well, I'll be here.
Later. Yes.
Thank you. Bye. Take care, everyone.